thank you and welcome back and welcome to the journey we are about to take through our gastrointestinal tract. And I just want to say how much I appreciate the piano playing. Thank you. Our journey begins in the mouth. The gastrointestinal tract is a very interesting part of our body because it's actually not part of our body. It's a hollow tube. And anything that goes into the gastrointestinal tract is not part of us until it gets out of the gut and into the blood. In fact, it's called an external environment because it's not part of us. That's why a lady said to me, Barbara, my little boy's got a cold. He keeps sniffing the mucus and swallowing it. I said, it's all right. It's just going to come out the other end because it's a hollow tube. And the mouth is the only part of the journey through our gastrointestinal tract that we have say over. We have five decisions that we make about what goes into our mouth. Yes, the first one is what? What goes in? Is it the best organic food? Is it prepared in the healthiest manner? Or is it just devitalized food that we haven't really thought about it? And as you will see, as we go down our gastrointestinal tract, these five decisions affect all the way down the gastrointestinal tract. But this is the only area that we have say over the digestion of the gastrointestinal tract. We have say over what goes in. We have say over how long it stays in the mouth. Is it choo-choo, swallow, choo-choo, swallow, choo-choo, swallow? Or is it chew, 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 till it gets broken down to tiny little substances? You see, the smaller it gets broken down, the larger the surface area that our enzymes have to work on. And there are no teeth in the stomach. The mouth is the only place, the only area in the whole of our gut that we have teeth. So please chew, chew, chew. My husband does everything fast. He drives fast, and as you saw yesterday, he was pretty fast in choosing his wife. Everything's fast. And he sometimes, in fact, often eats too fast. And so when we're at the table and I notice he's eating very fast, I touch his arm and I smile. And he looks at me and goes, ah. Puts his knife and fork down and chews a little bit slow. I don't know what's going on at the moment. I'm not there to touch his arm. So it's important to chew, chew, chew. And as you'll see as we go down our gastrointestinal tract, for the best running of our gut, we shouldn't be eating all day. So if I'm eating a meal and I get a phone call, I say, I'm busy. This is a very important part of the day. I'm eating. I'll call them back. And that brings me to the third point, is that we should cast off care, as one writer said. We should cast off care and anxious thought when we sit to dine. Please don't discuss any controversial issues at the table, because when we're stressed or anxious or upset, it blocks the release of our digestive enzymes. So please eat in a relaxed environment. If there are things happening, you're far better to deal with them and then sit. And please don't watch any hard and fast movies while you're eating. In fact, I think it's very sad that today that the sitting and eating together has often been lost. People are sitting in front of the television or sitting in front of the screen. Now, it's a very important part of the day, because the nourishment of our cells from our toes to our brain are dependent, yes, not only on what we're putting in, but actually the digestion. If it's not digested effectively, it can't even get out of our gut. So the fourth is we have say over how often. How often we eat. Is it every 2 hours? Or is it Is it just at mealtimes? A couple of times we've talked about the time-restricted eating, eating twice, 20 in 24 hours, 6 hours apart. That gives almost an 18-hour fast, a nice rest to the stomach. And the fifth one is we say over how much goes in. Is it 5 platefuls of food or is it just a reasonable amount of food? And as we get into the stomach, you will see that even right there in the stomach, those 5 decisions, and they are outlined in my book, Sustain Me, and also Self-Heal by Design. I cover it in both books because it is such an important part of the health of the whole body is digestion. Now, there are only 2 foods that are broken down in the stomach, the mouth. And a lot of people don't realise that digestion begins in the mouth. Yes, under those 5 choices, the mouth is an alkaline environment, and one enzyme that's released in the mouth is called lingual lipase. And lingual lipase is an enzyme that's released from the sublingual gland under the tongue. And lingual lipase breaks down saturated fat. Only saturated fat. So what's saturated fat? That's butter, ghee, coconut oil, palm oil, avocado oil, and also macadamia have a concentration of saturated fat. So saturated fat is an amazing fat. It's an amazing fat because the breakdown begins in the mouth. So it's a lot easier on digestion than any other fat. And I trust I've convinced you successfully that fat isn't the problem. Yes, there are some dangerous oils, and they're the oils that have been extracted from hard seeds using high heat and chemical equipment. They're the dangerous fats. No, the saturated fat is unique in that the breakdown happens in the mouth under the action of lingual lipase released from the sublingual glands. Also, in the mouth is released a salivary amylase called ptyalin. And this salivary amylase, ptyalin, begins starch digestion. Another word for starch digestion is carbohydrates. So that's all our grains. So that'd be pastas and breads and cereals, pizzas, all of the grain foods. That breakdown begins in the mouth under the action of the salivary amylase ptyalin. But ptyalin is only in minute amounts in the mouth of a baby because they don't need much because they're just drinking milk. And the first teeth that a baby gets is 4 at the top and 4 at the bottom. And those 8 teeth are called milk teeth. And you know why they're called milk teeth? Because that's all babies should be having. Milk. But it's also taste time. That's when you can give the little one a piece of cucumber to chew on. Because those teeth appear about 7, 7.5 months. That's about when a baby sits. So 3 things must be present for any food. One is the baby can sit. The other one is the baby can feed itself. And the third is there's a few teeth there. But because it's milk teeth, that's what should be baby's main food is milk. Ptyalin is not in any noticeable amounts in the baby's mouth until the molars appear. Now, the molars can come through anywhere between 14 and 22 months of age. And what do the molars do? They grind. What do we grind? Grain. So it's not until 14 to 22 months of age, it can change from baby to baby. Babies should not be having any starch. So I discovered this when I was only 23 with my first baby. A friend of mine was in charge of the malabsorption syndrome ward at Camperdown Children's Hospital, Australia's largest children's hospital. He said, "This ward is full of babies who've been given starch too young." Because if they're given starch too young, they don't have the ptyalin to break it down. And what do the princes, remember Psalm 146, verse 3, put not your trust in princes, neither in the Son of Man, in whom there is no health. His breath goes forth, he returns unto his earth. In that very day his thoughts perish. In other words, it's just a human being. Put not your trust in princes. Who are the princes? They're the authorities in the field, the authorities in medicine, the authorities in nutrition, the authorities in any area. Put not your trust there, because sometimes they get it wrong, because it's just a man or a woman. And what the princes are telling women today, you must give your baby rice cereal between 4 and 6 months of age. 4 and 6 months of age? A lot of them don't even have any teeth. Babies don't usually sit till they're about 7 months old. I don't know about you, but I'm not interested in being fed slop while I lie on my back. And isn't that what they're doing to babies? And the babies, when they suck, they use their tongue and their top lip. That's what they use to suck. So when you put this slop, this, I don't know what else to call it, this rice cereal, when you put it into their mouth, they go like that and it comes straight back out. Have you noticed? So they scoop it up and shove it back in, and the baby goes like that again and pops around. It doesn't make any sense at all to me. What's the baby telling the mother? Too soon. But what the princes tell the mother is you must, because breast milk doesn't have enough iron in it in the second 6 months. You see, breast milk has more iron in it in the first 6 months compared to the second 6 months. Has God made a mistake? God does not make mistakes. That breast milk is perfect for that baby at every age. But the princes come along and say, oh, the breast milk's not enough in the second 6 months of age. Well, have you seen how much a baby grows in the first 6 months compared to how much a baby grows in the second 6 months? It's not rocket science. The growth in the first 6 months is the biggest growth in their whole life. So their need for iron is greater in the first 6 months compared to the second 6 months. You don't have to be a pediatrician to work that out. You don't have to be a nutritionist to work that out. We've got common sense. And you know, common sense isn't very common today. But that's the gift that God has given us, and it gets stronger with use, by the way. So I didn't give any of my babies food. I might give them a bit of cucumber. And guess what that does? That teaches them to chew. When all they get is slop, they don't learn to chew. And I was reading the report of a dentist, and he claims that giving babies just nothing but soft food, they don't learn to chew, and their teeth and their jaws and their muscle, the masseter muscle here, do you know it's the strongest muscle in the human body? And he claims a lot of teeth problems and jaw problems are because babies don't learn to chew. So I learnt this at 23 when my first baby was a little baby. So I didn't give any of my babies food. If they could sit and they could feed themselves, I'd give them a piece of cucumber, give them a piece of celery, give them a piece of apple. And some people say, but what if they choke? Well, they gag a bit, but then it pops out again. They all do that. But do you know who does choke? The baby that's only ever had slop, only ever had soft food, and at the age of 3, you give them a nut and they don't know how to chew, they swallow it and they start to choke, and it's a quiet thing. Gagging is really noisy. See, there's a big difference between gagging and choking. This information needs to go out. So you have my permission to photograph the page, what shall I feed my baby, and give it to every mother you know. So my son James, and by the way, why do the mothers give it? They give it because of fear, because they're told their baby won't develop properly, their baby will be anemic, their baby or brain won't develop properly. Where did that come from? Do you know this is only a new theory You know what that means? Einstein, Galileo, Rembrandt, all the geniuses from time past, often they didn't eat food till they were 3 or 4. Did they suffer? Not at all. So my son James, he was not interested in eating any food till he was 16 months of age. And because of what I knew, I didn't push it. Little boy running around, strong, nice size, developing well. All he ate was breast milk. Let's look at James now. Looks like a bodybuilder. He's got his own little baby now. And this little baby's 5 months old and she's still not as big as his arms. And he's a musician, plays the pan pipes, and he's a master builder, and he's an incredible artist. He doesn't seem to have suffered. And yet that's what mothers are told. But it's not true. That's what you've got to remember. That's why I love that psalm. Put not your trust in princes. Doesn't mean you don't get their opinion. And don't go into argument with them. If they say, you've got to feed your baby food, what do you say? Thank you so much for your opinion. I'm going to seriously consider this. And you leave, and what do you say under your breath? Don't call me, I'll call you. Because it's your God-given right to feed your baby the way you feel is best. Let's go down now and the amazing swallowing process. We do it all the time, but we don't think about it. The swallowing process closes the trachea, which goes into your lungs, and it opens your esophagus. And as you swallow, it's a muscular contraction. It causes the esophagus to contract, and that contraction causes the cardiac sphincter that sits at the top of the stomach to also contract, which causes it to open and the food comes into the stomach. So when this stomach acid, because you see the environment in the stomach is acid, and it should be acid. And if someone has reflux, heartburn, is the acid coming up? The problem's not the acid. The problem's the gate. To shoot the acid, to take antacids, is like shooting all the cows because they keep getting into the vegetable garden. Don't shoot the cows, shut the gate. That's all you have to do, shut the gate, because you need that acid. How do we shut the gate? Strengthen that muscle. It sits right in the middle of your diaphragm. Your diaphragm is the muscle that goes across here. Strengthen your diaphragm, then you'll strengthen that muscle, and you'll strengthen the diaphragm by strengthening the core muscles. The strength of the body can be determined by the strength of the core. That's why push-ups. If you can't do push-ups, we should be doing them every day. It was raining this morning, couldn't get out, couldn't dive in American River this morning, unfortunately. I walked out the door with my little plastic bag and my towel. It was raining. Maybe tomorrow morning. So I did push-ups. I did 25 this morning. Strengthen your core. Muscle knows no age. Whether you're 9 or 90, you can have strong muscles. So if you go to the doctor with reflux, will he tell you to do push-ups every day? Will he talk to you about strengthening your core, because your diaphragm sits in the, well, it sits at the top of your abdominal muscles, but your cardiac sphincter sits in the middle of there, in the middle of your diaphragm. Strengthen your core. It's one of the best things you can do for your back, is strengthen your core, because all your core muscles are linked to your spine. But also, having breakfast like a king and lunch like a queen and supper like a pauper means when you lie down to bed, you haven't got the meal pushing against your cardiac sphincter. And that's what's happening with many people that eat breakfast like a pauper, lunch like a pauper, and supper is the king and the queen together. I know in Australia a lot of people eat like that. And on our way home at night, we see those big restaurants with about 50 cars outside. Well, they're not eating like a pauper, are they? They're eating a large meal late at night, then they lie down, and the gravity causes that meal in the stomach to push, push, push. It's not the odd day you have dinner with friends, and it's not the odd day you don't. It's what you do every day that determines your health status, especially the health status of your cardiac sphincter. So we see anyone that comes to our retreat with reflux or heartburn, they go home without it because we give them breakfast like a king, lunch like a queen, and at night we just have a very thin soup. We give them magnesium because that's a muscle. When it's relaxed, it's closed. When it opens, it's tightening. So if someone's stressed out and their muscles are tense, that can also cause it to open. Now we've come into the stomach. And the stomach is an interesting organ. It's lined with big folds like this. And these folds are lined with gastric glands. And 2/3 of these gastric glands release mucus. And that mucus is important because that mucus causes a thick mucosal wall to line the stomach. Yesterday, when we looked at water and salt, I told you the story of the man who had Helicobacter pylori. And remember, he didn't drink any water between meals, which means that Helicobacter pylori was getting out of control because his hydrochloric acid was low because he was drinking with his meals. He'd lost that thick mucosal wall because he was dehydrated between meals. It was probably about 20 years ago, I found a book, and this book was written in 1844, and it was written by Dr. William Beaumont. And Dr. William Beaumont, it's an incredible story. I'd read this story referred to in a few nutrition books. He was only 25 at the time, but he was called to go to an accident in a trading store where a shotgun had gone off and it had blown out part of the stomach of a young 18-year-old man called Alexis St. Martin. Dr. Beaumont attended him, declared he would not live, but took him to hospital and did the best he could, but he healed. Not overnight, of course, but little by little by little, Alexis St. Martin healed. But when he healed with a hole in his stomach. It looked like a mouth almost, and it had a little flap of skin over it. Dr. Beaumont said he could have stitched it, but Alexis St. Martin said, nah, enough, I don't want you to touch me anymore. But Dr. Beaumont saw his opportunity, and he invited Alexis St. Martin to come and live at his house and help him with chores. He'd chop the wood, he'd, you know, do basic things, mow the lawn, mulch the fruit trees, but Dr. Beaumont would spend several hours a day doing experiments on him. He'd get a piece of silk thread, put a bit of food on it, put it in the hole, and then 2 hours later pull it out, put it back in the hole. And what he discovered was that digestion, on an average, took 3.5 to 4 hours. Now, obviously, if Alexis St. Martin had a plate of watermelon, that would be digested in probably about 2 hours. But this is a meal that's high in fibre, generous protein, great fats. So an average meal took 3.5 to 4 hours to digest. And then he noticed that the stomach worked well if it had a rest of 1 hour. So what does that equal? That equals approximately 5 hours between meals. And interesting that today they're claiming that the time-restricted eating is the best way to eat. And that gives 5 to 6 hours between meals. In his book, The Physiology, Observations on the Physiology of Digestion by Dr. William Beaumont, I don't think they reprinted it. They'd have to almost have someone rewrite it because it's all written in Old English. And because I read the King James Version of the Bible, I could read it quite easily. But the first 2/3 of the book is his experiments. He meticulously documented what he found. And what he found was that there are five things that cause the food to be still in the stomach 8 hours later. One was if Alexis and Martin overate. If he overate, not all the food, but some of breakfast would still be in the stomach 8 hours later. Dr. Pomon came to the conclusion that only so much digestive enzymes are released. If too much food goes in, it just can't effectively break it down. If he often ate, how come if he often ate? And hasn't that what diabetics have been told for the last 30 years? You've got to eat every 2 hours. Notice they don't say, sorry, we made a mistake. What do they say? New research reveals. Time-restricted eating is the best. But look at the old adage, breakfast like a king, lunch like a queen, supper like a pauper. That old adage has been around for hundreds of years. This is not new. What happens when you eat often every couple of hours? Let's say breakfast comes in and it's taking 3.5 to 4 hours. Often after a couple of hours, the pyloric sphincter starts to open and lets little bits of food come through, especially the ones that break down quickly, which would be like the fruits. And so here's breakfast and it's little by little going through. But let's say at 10 o'clock in the morning, someone has a biscuit, maybe a biscuit and a cup of coffee, maybe they have a croissant, maybe they have donut, or maybe they're really healthy and have an apple and a handful of nuts. No matter what they have, this pyloric sphincter has sensors and it picks up, something's just come in, it's not broken down, quick, shut the gate. And that gate will stay shut until this newcomer comes and joins breakfast, and then it'll open. And then a little bit more goes through. And then a couple of hours later, lunch comes in. Quick, shut the gate, something's just come in, it's not broken down. This explains why after 8 hours, there can be still remnants of breakfast in the stomach. Also, if he had alcohol interfered with the digestion of the stomach. If he had large fluid with the meal, we've been talking about this a few times this week. If he had large fluid with the meal, what Dr. Beaumont found that when the person had a lot to drink with the meal, it diluted the stomach acid. So digestion was put on hold, the liquid had to be taken out in an attempt to bring that acidity back to be able to resume digestion. And that's why the food can, not all the food, but some of the food still in the stomach 8 hours later, and if he was stressed. These are the five things that Dr. Beaumont found caused food to be still in the stomach 8 hours later. And how many people today you can give a tick for all of that? So 2/3 of these gastric glands release mucus, but from the middle here, hydrochloric acid is released. Also, another enzyme called pepsinogen. And pepsinogen and hydrochloric acid unite and release pepsin. And pepsin is the enzyme that breaks down protein. But the union of hydrochloric acid and pepsinogen will only happen effectively in a very acid environment. And pepsin will only work in a very acid environment. And that's why if someone says to me, I've got a very acid stomach, I say, great. You must be digesting your food well because the stomach should be acid. Dogs have 10 times the hydrochloric acid that we do, And they don't have heartburn, they don't have reflux, they don't have stomach ulcers. No, the acid is important. And God designed the stomach such that it has a thick mucosa wall which can effectively protect the lining of the stomach. Drinking drinking a glass of water half an hour before the meal effectively thickens that mucosa lining. We should stop drinking half an hour before the meal and resume drinking about an hour and a half after the meal. Something else is released by the parietal glands, and that's the intrinsic factor. So what's the intrinsic factor? The intrinsic factor is the factor that is required to absorb vitamin B12. When vitamin B12 is found in food, it's locked up with the R protein. But when it comes into the stomach, hydrochloric acid releases R protein and vitamin B12. And then vitamin B12 and the intrinsic factor float together down to the last part of the small intestine. Then they unite, then they're absorbed up into the enterohepatic circulation, which is a circulatory system that holds the B12 until it is needed by the body. Do you know what this means? Someone can have no B12 in their diet for 30 years before they will show a deficiency. Most people that are vitamin B12 deficient are vitamin B12 deficient because of low hydrochloric acid, and if they've got low hydrochloric acid, they will also have low intrinsic factor. Why? Because they're eating all day long, they're stressed, they're drinking with their meals, they're eating their largest meal at the end of the day. I've met people who have a vitamin B shot every 6 months. Is it working? No, what one must investigate is why. Why? And meat eaters and vegetarians alike can all have vitamin B deficiency. You see, vitamin B12 is a bacteria. So vitamin B12 is found on homegrown vegetables, it's found in... You eat an apple off a tree, you're getting vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 deficiency is more a problem in the stomach rather than dietary. Now we come through the pyloric sphincter into the duodenum. And the duodenum is the first part of the small intestine. And the duodenum is an alkaline environment. And the pancreas, it releases sodium bicarbonate, and it releases sodium bicarbonate to ensure that this environment remains alkaline. So you'll see in the duodenum, we've got the liver. Underneath the liver is the gallbladder. The gallbladder is a reservoir for bile. The gallbladder doesn't make bile, the liver makes bile. So if you are one of those unfortunate people who've had your gallbladder taken out, I'm so sorry to hear that. The good news is your liver still makes bile because the gallbladder is a reservoir. It holds the bile. So the liver releases bile. And bile emulsifies or breaks up into tiny little particles, unsaturated fat. Remember where the saturated fats breakdown began? It began in the mouth under the action of lingual lipase. But the unsaturated fat, it's not broken down till it gets to the duodenum, and the bile from the liver, which is stored in the gallbladder, breaks it down to tiny particles. The pancreas also releases pancreatic lipase, and pancreatic lipase is the enzyme that finalizes the breakdown of unsaturated fat. The pancreas also releases pancreatic amylase. Do you remember in the mouth salivary amylase called ptyalin began starch digestion. And starch digestion began in the mouth, and that's why it's important to chew, 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 and then that mix gets into the stomach, and it probably takes maybe 15, 20 minutes before the acidity infiltrates and starch digestion stops. It's put on hold till it gets back down into another alkaline environment in the duodenum, and then under the action of pancreatic amylase, starch digestion is finalized. That's why it's important to chew, chew, chew. If it's chew, chew, swallow, chew, chew, swallow, chew, chew, swallow. Sometimes starch can reach the duodenum and it hasn't barely even the digestion begun. So to make it easier for the pancreas, chew your starch. Make sure it's well mixed with your ptyalin. And if it is, if you chew the bread, the pasta, the starches very, very well, then that starch can sometimes be almost half digested before it gets to the duodenum. Oh, and that makes it much easier for the pancreas. The pancreas also releases the trypsin brothers. Who are the trypsin brothers? Well, the trypsin brothers are chymotrypsin and trypsin. And these trypsin brothers finalize protein digestion. Protein digestion began in the stomach under the action of pepsin. And let me show you how it happens. Here is protein. And under the action of pepsin, protein is broken down to peptides and polypeptides. And then the peptides and the polypeptides come into the duodenum, and under the action of the trypsin brothers, peptides is broken down to amino acid, and polypeptides is broken down to peptides and amino acid, then amino acid. And it's only as these singular structure, these singular amino acids, can it be absorbed out of the gut and into the blood. But let me show you what happens often, unfortunately. The protein is not getting broken down to peptides and polypeptides in the stomach because this person's drinking with their meals and they're eating all day long and they're having their largest meal at the end of the day and the stress is blocking the release of their digestive enzymes. And so instead of peptides and polypeptides getting into the duodenum, there are some full proteins getting into the duodenum. And the pancreas says, "What are you doing here?" And the protein says, well, they're drinking with their meals, they're eating all day long, they're eating their largest meal at the end of the day. And the trypsin brothers say, we'll do the best we can, but all they can do is bring protein down to peptides and polypeptides. And you will discover that halfway down our small intestine, all our food is absorbed. But peptide and the polypeptide can't be absorbed. Only singular structures can be absorbed. And so the peptide and the polypeptide get into the colon and the colon says, what are you doing here? And the peptide and the polypeptide said, well, they're drinking all day, they're eating all day long, they're drinking with their meals, they're stressed out, and the trypsin brothers did the best they could. So the colon says, all right. So it creates a lot of extra bacteria to try and calm it down a bit as it journeys through, and that causes methane gas. You've heard of methane gas? Can you see how important it is back in the mouth to chew? Chew, chew, leave breaks between the meals. drink between the meals, not with the meals, because what we do in the mouth affects the whole of the way down. But you can get some proteolytic enzymes. What are proteolytic enzymes? Proteolytic enzymes are enzymes that break down protein. Pepsin is a proteolytic enzyme. The trypsin brothers are proteolytic enzymes. But God, in his wisdom and mercy, put some proteolytic enzymes in certain foods. In the pineapple core, you will find bromelain. And bromelain is a proteolytic enzyme. So please, don't cut the core out of your pineapple. This is what I do. You slice the pineapple, that's a slice of pineapple, and you cut the pineapple like this so that everyone gets a tiny little bit of core, because it'll be a bit heavy going to try and eat a core. Tough stuff. But if you cut the pineapple like that, everyone just gets a little bit. I have since discovered that if you peel the pineapple and boil up the skin has proteolytic enzymes. And when you boil up the skin, leave it there to cool, strain it, and that's a little drink that can be drunk just before each meal. And if it's hot, that's absorbed very, very quickly, just even a third of a glass, and it'll help you to break down your protein because it contains proteolytic enzyme. Papain is found in the pawpaw or the papaya, and it's found especially in the seeds. We don't advocate black pepper because black pepper can be have an irritating effect on the lining of the gut. And I was reading in one paper that every black pepper they tested had fungus. It appears to mold very easily as it dries. But keep your pepper grinder, because what you can do is you can get the seeds out of the papaya, wash them, spread them out, dry them in the dehydrator or a very low oven, and put those little black seeds in your pepper grinder. And when your guests come, they won't even know the difference. And they can grind it on their meal. It might taste a little different, but it has a bite to it. And so that's an easy way to boost your proteolytic enzyme, is having a healthy black pepper. If someone has pancreatic cancer or pancreatic insufficiency, it's vital that they have those proteolytic enzymes. And you can buy digestive enzymes that'll have bromelain and papain in them. In fact, often you will find if someone has pancreatic cancer, they don't live very long. They often die quickly of malnutrition, because the pancreas, as you can see, is the main organ of digestion. The pancreas finalizes the unsaturated fat, the starch digestion, and the protein digestion. And now we're moving down. All that's left is the insoluble fiber. And that insoluble fiber is important. But before we have a look at that, let's have a closer look at the grand finale of digestion. The small intestine is lined with villi. And these villi, up the middle, have the lacteal, and the lacteal is part of the lymphatic system, and the unsaturated fats get absorbed straight into the lacteal. Whereas the saturated fat, it gets absorbed into the blood. Coating the villi is Lactobacillus acidophilus, bifidus bacterium. They're the two main, and they, from them, all the other bacteria are made, and that's our microbiome. But what I didn't show you is there are little villi on the big villi. And what that does is that creates a huge surface area. And this huge surface area allows a huge amount of nutrients to be absorbed. It is estimated at something like 4 miles of surface area in the small intestine. That's quite incredible. And this microbiome is responsible for the final breakdown of our food. But we've just looked at all the enzymes that are breaking our food down. So what do the microbiome break down? They cause a release of melatonin. Melatonin is a very important hormone that's released in the night to help us sleep. They cause a release of the B vitamins. B vitamins are vital, they're called brain vitamins. These microbiome also cause a release of glutathione. Glutathione is not found directly in any foods. It's actually created under the action of these microbiomes. And glutathione is hailed as the most potent antioxidant. This microbiome is responsible for the absorption of our nutrients out of our gut and into our blood. These microbiome are responsible for the nourishment of the cells that line the small intestine. This microbiome, as we just looked at, play a protective role. They protect the blood from any harmful pathogens that might be in the gut. They protect the blood against that. No wonder Hippocrates said, all disease begins in the gut. But as I showed in the last lecture, antibiotics, statin drugs, many medications knock off this microbiome. We've now lost our final breakdown. We've now lost the absorption, the proper absorption of nutrients out of their gut and into their blood. Our cells that line the gut have lost their nourishment. We've also lost the protection. How can we build up that microbiome? We can build up the microbiome by including cultured foods in our diet. Those cultured foods can be sauerkraut, yogurt, and you can get, a lot of people think we can't eat yogurt because we're not eating dairy. Well, you can get coconut yogurt, you can get cashew yogurt, you can get all sorts of yogurts. You can also get kefir, and you can get water kefir. Kefir is like another culturing product. Miso, kimchi, there's lots of cultured foods. So they're called probiotics. They're called probiotics because of the microbiome that they have, those Lactobacillus acidophilus. But we also need prebiotics. What are the prebiotics? Prebiotics feed the probiotics. So prebiotics feed the microbiome. Where do you get prebiotics? Fiber, plant fiber. All plant fiber is high in prebiotics. As I mentioned, I think it was last night, you get 10 different grapes. Each grape feeds a different microbiome. We should have at least 10 different fibers in each meal. So let me count my fiber in breakfast. I had a grapefruit, I had chia seed, I had an almond, I had Brazil nuts, I had the Simple Needs toast, I had avocado, I had red lentils on there. I had 7 different types of fiber that fed 7 different types of microbiome. And then lunch was totally different. I can't remember how many greens we had. We had a lot of different greens. And avocado and tomato and I think we had like a barlotti bean and an onion and there's a whole lot there. We should count at least 7 different types of fibre per meal. So the fibre is vital to fuel or feed your microbiome. Flipping back a bit, how can we boost hydrochloric acid? Yes, eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a queen, and supper like a pauper. Yes, drink water between meals and not with meals. But taking the juice of a lemon just before the meal can boost your acidity in the stomach. Having a little drink, say quarter of a cup of hot ginger tea, that can boost. Having a third of a teaspoon of cayenne pepper in a third of a glass of water. Cayenne pepper will wake anything up. So I just realised I hadn't mentioned that. Now we're back here and we're looking at boosting the microbiome. But all we've got left after the absorption of our nutrients, all we should have left, is insoluble fibre. And all your plant foods are very high in insoluble fibre. And when the contents comes out of the small intestine into the large, it comes through the ileocecal valve. And that ileocecal valve is a one-way valve, because we don't want anything from here going back in there. And one of the main functions of the colon is to take water out, so stools are formed. So that by the time it gets around the large intestine, the colon, now the stools are formed. What does the colon need? It needs that insoluble fibre. That insoluble fibre bulks it, it sweeps all of these little corners and grooves, and it stimulates peristalsis to move through. So when we're having nice amounts of fibre in our diet, that encourages the colon to evacuate regularly. Dr. Kellogg, very famous doctor who wrote many books on health, many books on the colon, he said 3 intakes of food a day should equal 3 evacuations a day. And have you noticed that the colon's got a mind of its own? If you're going too much and you tell it to stop, it won't. And if you're not going enough and you tell it to go, have you noticed it won't? It needs gentle stimulation with that insoluble fibre as part of your diet. Also, it needs to be well hydrated, because if you're dehydrated, more water gets taken out than should be taken out. Then we're left with rabbit pellets and cement. Exercise. When you exercise every day, especially push-ups, especially your core strengthening exercises, what that does is that gently massages the colon. It also increases blood supply to the colon. So exercise is very important, especially if you are a sedentary worker, if you're at an office all day. In fact, every office should have rebounders. And if everyone in the office did 1 minute on the rebounder every hour, I can tell you now that the productivity in that office would go right up. One businessman said to me, he said his staff are leaving at 3 o'clock in the afternoon now. He took the coffee machine out and put water fountains there. He said, I can't tell the staff what to do, but I'm not supplying the coffee anymore. And he said he had the rebounder there. And, you know, productivity went up. And he said that the staff are happy. They're able to leave at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Also, the colon, if it's not working regularly, it might need a little help. And I've had people say, but I'm drinking water, but I'm exercising, but I'm having fibre in my diet, the plant foods. It's also important to relax. As one lady said to me, she's passed now, she said she was a teacher in colonic irrigation. She said, tight mind, tight colon. Relax. Still not going. And so what you can do, you can have a chia seed gel. So chia seed takes up to 25% its own weight in water. So to make this gel, it's third of a cup of chia seed and 3 cups of fluid. Now, it could be just water, it could be coconut water, it could be organic soy milk, but you shake it in a jar and you keep shaking it. and eventually it goes like a soft gel. And you can have a cup, half a cup of that poured all over your breakfast, half a cup of that in your smoothie, half a cup of that, maybe just even drink it with your lunch. But that gives a lovely soft fibre, like a gel, that stimulates movement through the colon. What happens if you're going too much? That's called irritable bowel, Crohn's disease, colitis, gastritis. In fact, I've had people come to our retreat and they said, I've got Crohn's disease and I've told it's an autoimmune disease. I said, oh, well, reject that one. Just reject that one, because we've seen people totally heal. There are five foods that have a particularly irritating effect on a colon that is inflamed. That is dairy. Dairy is great milk for baby calves. Wheat, the hybridization of the wheat in the 1950s created a very complex protein or gluten structure, very difficult for the inflamed gut to break down. Oats are high in a plant chemical called lectins. And if lectins get into the blood, it increases inflammation. If someone's got good gut flora, that can disarm the lectins. But I find someone with an inflamed gut, they do not have good gut flora. Peanuts, commonly contaminated with mold. Refined sugar is like pouring kerosene onto a fire. We had a man attend our program, and he had irritable bowel. He'd had it for 20 years. I said, what's your reason for coming to our retreat? He said, I'm here to support my wife. He was 69. And when I asked him questions, I discovered he'd had irritable bowel for a long time, so I'm immediately intrigued. I said, what do you have for breakfast? He said, I have toast, so wheat toast. Sometimes he has oats. He has peanut butter on it, or sometimes he has cheese on it. He has coffee with cow's milk and sugar. Mid-morning, he has another cup of coffee with more milk and more sugar and his wife's sugar biscuits, wheat and sugar. Lunch, he has a sandwich and he has a ham and cheese sandwich and his wife's sweet biscuits and another cup of coffee. So he was heavily eating all of these foods, and he did not know. He did not know that they have an irritating effect on an inflamed gut. And he said, and after tea every night, after supper, he said, I have a Jack Daniels and nibble on the peanuts. I said, can we try a few things? He said, do what you want. He said, the doctor's just told me he can do no more for me. He was on cortisone, 20 milligrams a day, and he was on anti-inflammatories. He said, I go for a walk every morning. I go along the beach, because Port Macquarie, that's where our closest airport is. It's a coastal town. He said, and there are four toilets. He said, and I know where all the toilets are, because he said, I go four times on my morning walk and then a couple more times through the day. So he's going six times a day. So we gave him slippery elm. And slippery elm is the powdered bark of the slippery elm tree. We gave him slippery elm four times a day. So we gave it to him 8 o'clock, midday, 6 o'clock, and then just before bed. Slippery elm coats, soothes, and heals the lining of the gut. It's the powdered bark of the slippery elm tree, so it's like a fluffy powder. You put hot water with it, and it goes like a soft gel, which coats and soothes. So I talked to him after, he came in Sunday. I talked to him Tuesday. I said, how's it going? He said, it's quite remarkable. He said, I've stopped bleeding from the colon. He said, my cramping stopped. He said, my stools are starting to have form. Now, Monday, Tuesday are juicing days. And his stool has form. I said, interesting. So by the end of the third day, And the third day he had breakfast and his lunch. I said, how's it going? He said, I have no more cramping. I have no more bleeding. My stools are formed. He said, instead of going 6 times a day, I'm only going 4, sometimes 3 times a day. He said, this is remarkable. I said, well, I can't tell you what to do with your medication, but this is what I'd do. I'd stop the anti-inflammatories, because the fact that there's no bleeding, no cramping, no pain, and the stools have slowed down, that tells me your inflammation's come down. So we stopped the anti-inflammatories. No reaction. What would we have done if he'd started to have a bit of diarrhea? Well, you could go back on the anti-inflammatories, or you could just take Slippery Elm every 2 hours, which is what I'd do. On the last day, it was Sunday morning, he came running up to me. He said, I'm so excited. I've just gone on a walk and I haven't even gone. In 1 week, 30 years he's had this. And he was off half his medication. I said, you're going to have to go very slow off the cortisone. I said, if you keep to this diet, if you keep that out of your food program, if you have the Slippery Elm. Now, he was willing to do anything, because what had the doctor just told him? He could do no more for him. In fact, the next option was to start having his colon cut out. 1 week of doing the right things, and he didn't realise. Now, when I asked him why he'd come, do you remember what he said? I'm just here to support my wife. But he found healing in these simple, simple methods. So he was on 20 milligrams of cortisone a day. What he did was, after another week, he brought it back to 15. No reaction. He waited another 4 weeks, brought it back to 10. Waited another 4 weeks, brought it back to 5. So within 6 months, he was off all his medication and had no symptoms of irritable bowel, Crohn's disease. Did he have an autoimmune disease? What are we told with autoimmune disease? There's no cure. I don't believe that. Remember what you say. Thank you for your opinion. I'm going to seriously consider this. But what an incredible body we live in, that has this inbuilt ability to heal when you give it the right conditions. And that's why I believe that God designed each one of us to be our own doctor, because only you know how you feel, only you know how these different things affect. And an important part of being your own doctor is listening.